Okay, hey Dhamma friends, so we have come to the next item of this mindfulness for young adults session. So that is a short sermon on this selected sutta. And nowadays we are discussing Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. Here Buddha explains mainly about the non-self, the teaching of non-self. So you might have heard that there are universal characteristics. Mainly three characteristics are highlighted. One is the impermanence, anicca. The other one is dukkha, that is the unsatisfactoriness, we can say. And the third one is the anatta, the non-self. So in this Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, Buddha is highlighting the point of the non-self. So this sutta has preached while Buddha resides at the Varanasi. So probably you can remember the first sermon of the Buddha is recognized as Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. So once he preached that to the five ascetics, Panchavaggiya Bhikkhu, Venerable Kondanya, attained Sotapanna. And then the following days, Buddha continued to preach, and there are the other four ascetics also attained Sotapanna. And next, to all of them, Buddha preached Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, and after hearing that, everybody attained Arahantship. So this is, therefore, we can understand has preached to someone who is already in the practice. So it is not merely a kind of a teaching that is given to non-practitioners, rather it is given to the practitioners. So therefore, the theme of non-self is in a way we should apply at the right place. So immediately, if you think that there is no self, so then there is, why are we all suffering like this? So why we need to strive hard to attain the, say, continue our path if there is no self? So you can't could make use of the non-self teaching as an excuse like that. So at the beginning, so we are sort of playing on the level of Lokiya Sammaditti, mundane type of Sammaditti. So there is a kind of a level of ignorance, but that is necessary. So that is called mundane Sammaditti or Lokiya Sammaditti. Atti Bhikkave Sammaditti. Sasava Punya Bhagya Upadi Vepakka. So Buddha emphasized that there is a type of Sammaditti. So that is with fetters, but it contributes towards the wholesome side. And again, it provides various beneficial assets or requisites or acquisitions. And once one is well established in that type of Sammaditti, right view, then one can grow further into the supramundane type of Sammaditti. So this teaching of, we can say, the non-self is in the supramundane side, where one is developing further to improve one's understanding, to improve one's knowledge, one's wisdom. And this wisdom is not merely kind of a book knowledge, but rather a kind of a meditative knowledge, experiential knowledge. So it's a kind of a knowledge that you gain through practice. You can actually listen to Dhamma, you can read Dhamma and get some understanding, some idea, but that understanding is not enough. But you yourself have to engage in the practice, and again, all the phenomena arising due to various causes have to be observed. And through this continuous observation, you may have a deeper understanding about these three universal characteristics. So you are observing various feelings, you are observing various, say, element characteristics. You are observing various perceptions, signs, marks. And today actually we can talk about this observation onto the fourth aggregate, that is the sankhara, or that is what we call as volitional formations. So this sutta actually talks about five aggregates, and the five aggregates and how they are actually non-self. Now, if we come to the form, this sankhara, volitional formations, so this is another aggregate that Buddha is showing us. So the whole experience, that what we are experiencing, what we are going through, can be divided into five groups. Say all the physical bodily parts, say eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and all the external sights, sounds, smells, taste, and the tactile sensations, all these are come to the physical side, and that is included in the form aggregate, rupakkhanda. And the various feeling tones, say pleasurable feelings, then the painful feelings, equanimous feelings, are all in, comes under the feeling aggregate. And we have various signs in our mind. So we, whenever we are seeing someone, we get certain information through that sight, and we are recording them. We are storing those information as marks, as signs. And later, if we see the same person, we can match or map with those data and then can recognize, oh, this is so and so. So likewise, we have various signs in our mind. So there are various signs, not in only limited to the mind, but even with various sounds, with various sights, with various smells, tastes, tactile sensations. So everywhere, all these different categories, various signs are available, various marks are available, and using which we are sort of maintaining kind of a recognition. We do recognize using those marks, signs. And that all comes under the perception aggregate or sanya khanda. And now when it comes to the sankhara aggregate, that's more interesting part. And once we see something, we don't stop there. Assume that you see a particular color, say red color. Assume it's a red color flag. So immediately we are coming up with some sort of a idea about it. Oh, this red color is really a beautiful color. So it may belong to a particular country. So that country is ruled by so and so. It's a rich country. It's a poor country. Now it is undergoing this and these problems. Now we start to think about that. So once we do the recognition first, once we have some sort of a feeling, so we don't stop there, but rather we start to put a thought about it. We start to have a thought, a second thought, a third thought. Likewise, we start in kind of a thinking machine, and now this thinking may even grow. So we may think in one direction, we may think in another direction, in a different perspective, in another perspective, another view. Maybe something mentioned in another book, or maybe someone has mentioned about it. So many different ways. Now this thinking process is sort of catching up. It's catching up with its momentum. Now this thinking going on and on, we can't even stop it now. It is called proliferation. This proliferation is now taking us for a ride. So we are now being driven by the proliferation. Now this kind of a process is there in our mind. So this all comes under sankhara. So we do some sort of a manipulation. We do some sort of a preparation. We do some sort of a construction. So whenever we see something, we do this construction, manipulation. Whenever we hear something, we do this construction. When we smell something, still we do this construction. We are adding our likes and dislikes onto it. So we are adding our preconceived ideas onto it. So our cultural, say, norms to it. And assume that we are sort of experiencing certain taste. So we also have certain likes or dislikes about it. So we are adding that. And again, if we are going through some sensations, bodily sensations, tactile sensations, still we are adding to that. We can't stop at the very the data level or the sensory level, but we do manipulations, we do constructions, we do a lot of preparations. As a result, a lot of thinking is now going on in the mind, and it can even lead to a proliferation. And we are adding various intentions. We are adding, later we may put kind of a volition also. Now I want to say, take hold of that flag. I want to own that flag, or I want to throw it away. So this is not my country's flag. So likewise, we may even have various volitional formations, various chetana volitions. Now, likewise, now this whole thinking process become kind of an ongoing thing, and we can't even stop it. So we are now getting to sort of regrets. We are getting to various, say, hateful manner thoughts, or even resistance, some sort of even agitation. On the other side, we may even have kind of a compassion, may have loving kindness, we have some sort of sympathy, so many things. So it can happen in both ways, either in the wholesome way or in the unwholesome way. So many different ways it can happen. So now all of these comes under this sankhara, the volitional formations. So you can see, so it's a kind of a deep aspect happening in our mind. And now mind has become somewhat complicated. So we probably have seen a kind of a red color, but now it is no more, not just the red color. Now I am having kind of a perception onto it. I am having a kind of a view about it, kind of an idea about it, my own comments about it, likes and dislikes about it. So it's a kind of, it has become kind of a confused state in the mind, kind of a very complicated state in the mind. Now it appear like quite solid. Now I want to do that. So I have a kind of a even intention, and even a kind of a ambition, or even a kind of a determination. So likewise, now things have grown to very high extent. So you can see, if we are able to look back, if we can use yoniso manasikara, if we can go back to the root, probably these formations, these proliferations might have started with very simple points, with very simple signs. Now here we have simply taken a red color. So that is the sign. But we have elaborated that, we have manipulated that, we have sort of formulated that, fabricated that into a huge thing. So, but if we look at the roots, if we look at the sources, its start, beginning, there is nothing much. So there is no any kind of an essence there. There is nothing substantial there. There is no inner core. But once it has become manifested, once we add so many things to it, once we weave a net from it, so then it becomes something. Now, therefore, Buddha gave a very beautiful simile. Probably you can remember our previous sutta discussion, that is the Penapindukapa Sutta. So onto this, Sankhara, Buddha gave a very beautiful simile. It's like a banana trunk. So in the banana trunk, you see, you know, that even though it appear like solid from outside, it appear like it has hardwood, but once you cut it, there is no hardwood. So all kind of sheath, kind of peelings. So you can peel it out, and ultimately there is nothing there. There is nothing substantial. There is no any hardwood. So likewise, if we are able to look at these mental formations, volitional formations, if we closely look at them, if we closely analyze them, if we are able to go back and find out the roots, there you will understand there is no any kind of a core. So they appear like kind of a empty, nothing substantial. So this is kind of an understanding that we have to gain through our own practice. Now, in this situation, Buddha, in this Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, Buddha directly mentioned Sankhara Anatta. So all these formations are non-self. So none of them really is you, really is me, really is I. It's non-self. Now if we are telling that I am a hateful person, I am a lovable person, I am having my loving kindness, I am having my hate, I am having my love, I am having my hatred. Now they are actually, we are trying to personify all these different qualities. But Buddha mentioned they are merely sankhara. They are merely volitional formations. They are not substantial. And you can't claim that they as you. You can't claim that they as yourself. So they are merely arising due to various causes, especially due to contact. And once those contact is eliminated, those causes are eliminated, so these formations also stop. And here, Buddha mentioned, Sankharacha hidam bhikkave atta abhavissa, naidam sankhara abhadaya sangmatteya. Now, if there is a self to these volitional formations, so they can't change or they can't subject to various some sort of deformations. Suppose you are having kind of a loving kindness. So you do loving kindness practice. That is your most preferred, say, practice. And you are sort of spreading loving kindness to the whole universe. Assume that you are in the middle of your practice. Assume that while you are enjoying that bliss, someone immediately come and knock to the door. So you immediately start to hate that person. So you start to think, why this fellow has come at this beautiful moment? I can't enjoy my meditation. I was in a really beautiful situation. This fellow has ruined that situation. Now you start immediately hating that person. Now what has happened to the loving kindness? So that loving kindness has completely changed. So if you had kind of a authority on that loving kindness, you should be able to regain that quickly or to re-establish that loving kindness. Or you can have kind of a mastery over it. You can control over it. But most often we can understand, so we don't sometimes have such kind of a capacity. So none of these qualities behave as we wish. So the necessary conditions, causes and conditions are needed in order to maintain them. Otherwise, they are subjected to various variations, changes. So that is why Buddha here emphasized, Yasma chako bhikkave sankhara anatta, since amongst these volitional formations are non-self, tasma sankhara abhadaya sangvattanti. So because of that, all these volitional formations are subjected to various afflictions, various changes, alterations. Nacha labbati sankharesu evam me sankhara huntu evam me sankhara ma ahesunti. So you can't simply wish, may I have these kinds of mental qualities, may I have free from, may my mind free from all these kind of mental qualities. You can't simply wish them and have them. Or you can't simply wish them and get rid of them. Say if you want to have a complete loving kindness, really beautiful kind of a mindset. So if it is, everything is under your control. So at the instant that you wish it, it should appear. But it doesn't happen like that. And even when, assume that you do some continuous practice and you are now trying to maintain such qualities in your mind and you want to hold them, still they may slip away. You are not sure when they are going to disappear. So likewise, all these various mental qualities, either wholesome or unwholesome, are subjected to various afflictions, are subjected to various changes. Now here, Buddha directly asks, are these volitional formations, are they permanent or impermanent? So this category Buddha directly asks. So actually, in order to answer this question, you should have have kind of a previous experience. You should have observed these various mental qualities. Say you have observed how this loving kindness is manifesting in your mind, how these hateful thoughts manifesting in your mind, how these say sympathetic thoughts manifesting in your mind, how these sort of harmful thoughts manifesting in your mind. So either in the wholesome or unwholesome, so they become only different types of thoughts, different kinds of say thinking patterns. So you are observing them, and as a result of this observation, so you have your own findings. So you recognize that they appear due to various causes. They come up or pops up. And if I am not promoting them, if I am not fertilizing them, they disappear. They don't stay for a long time. Suppose you get some hateful thought. Now, if you are not promoting it, if you are not fertilizing it, then this hateful thought also quickly passes away. But unfortunately, what happens is we are adding so much things to that thought, and we are constructing it, we are building it. And as a result of that, now we start to burn from anger. Now, this is how we are actually sort of exaggerating the situation and start to make unnecessary sort of fuss about it. So we are messing up the thing. But instead doing like that, if you are able to simply recognize this hateful thought as a hateful thought, and if we are able to leave it aside or simply allow it to be, then it will naturally cease. By looking at this process, now you understand it is impermanent. It does not come here to stay forever. Rather, it has the nature to pass away. So it due to various causes, it has the nature to arise. And then if various other causes are not maintained, not sufficiently provided, then it will cease. So you understand the impermanent nature. So therefore, Buddha mentioned these all different kinds of volitional formations are impermanent. So these monks are answering they as impermanent. So they are giving their own experiential answer. And then Buddha asked, so is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? So the monks answer, it is suffering. Because at a given state, at a given moment, it appears like happiness. But on the next moment, it can completely change to something else. So if something is completely changing to a different thing, so we can't expect it to provide continuous happiness. So whatever the level, whatever the state that we accept as happy can't be maintained. It may change to something else, to some other level. So there we found it is unsatisfactory. And then Buddha makes an argument, kind of a logic, what is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus. This is mine, this is I am, this is myself. So Buddha logically asks, so if something is impermanent, if something is subject to change, if something is providing sort of unsatisfactoriness, is it worth telling it as me, mine, myself? Then these monks answer, no. Now, therefore, Buddha mentioned, whatever the volitional formations, either it may be past, that means already happened, or going to happen in the future, or currently happening, it may be internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near. So any of these volitional formations should be seen as it really is, should be seen as it really are, with correct wisdom, that they are not mine, they are not myself, they are not I am. So they are, then Buddha further mentioned, so if one understands this process, now again and again you are observing the mind and again you understand the arising of these various mental formations, and you understand how impermanent they are, how quickly they are disappearing, how quickly they are changing to something else. So you understand that there is nothing substantial. Now, as a result of this observation, so you understand that all these thoughts start to sort of dilute, start to fade away. So once you are mindful about these thoughts, now they simply fade away. Previously, it was not like that. So once you are trying to look at them, they may even grow. And ultimately, you are kind of a victim of that thinking, that kind of proliferation. But as you develop mindfulness, probably you might have noticed, now these thoughts, these thinking processes are weakening. They lose their grip. They lose their strength. As a result, what happens, once you become mindful, so these thoughts start to disappear. These thoughts start to fade away. So now you can even understand. So it's not worthy of holding to any of those thoughts. Either it may be wholesome, either it may be unwholesome. They all have the impermanent nature. Therefore, they can't provide lasting happiness. Again, there is no inner core there. There is nothing substantial. Even though appear like a huge thing, once I am analyzing them, once I go to the root, to the source, there is nothing substantial there. So therefore, not worthy of holding them. It is not necessary to hold even many wholesome thoughts. It is not that we are trying to think the most best, generous, best kind of thoughts and try to hold those thoughts. And it is not that we are trying to hate ourselves, condemn ourselves, telling that this mind, I am useless, I am always thinking something bad, always thinking hateful thoughts, always thinking lustful thoughts. It's not that you are trying to hate yourself. Rather, you understand all these thoughts, either wholesome or unwholesome, have the nature to come and go. So therefore, you can't have happiness just by holding to any of these thoughts. You can't have happiness simply by holding loving kindness thoughts, because that may pass away. You can't have happiness just holding lustful thoughts. They also pass away. You can't have continuous lust for several days. You can't have continuous, say, loving kindness for several days. It may deplete, it may reduce, it may disappear. So therefore, holding to any of these sankhara, these volitional formations, is not a kind of a lasting business. You can't depend on them. So then, kind of a disenchantment. So now you are simply having kind of a dispassion towards them. No point of holding to these loving kindness thoughts. No point of holding to these lustful thoughts or harmful thoughts. How about simply leaving them aside? Now here Buddha mentioned Nibbindam Virajyate. Now once you have kind of a disenchantment towards all these different volitional formations, as a result, now you have an idea. How about simply, in a way, to avoid thinking, calming down thinking, to silence in the mind, to letting go all this thinking, and to allow the mind to settle, allow the mind to be still, allow the mind to be peaceful, just calm. So this is another perspective now the yogi is getting. Viraga vimuchyati. Now the mind is free from wholesome thoughts and unwholesome thoughts. Not only unwholesome thoughts, but the mind is now even free from wholesome thoughts. It is free from any thinking. Now you are observing kind of an inner silence, kind of a stillness, calmness, peacefulness, non-attached nature in the mind. So now the mind is free from any thinking, free from any bonding, free from any kind of a grasping, any holding. So there the mind is free. So now mind is not holding to anything, not leaning onto anything, not attracted to anything, not grasping anything. Since there is nothing to grasp, nothing to associate, now it has its own freedom. Viraga vimuchati. Since there is a dispassion, there is a kind of a freedom. Now the mind has temporarily liberated, temporarily free. But unfortunately, we can't maintain it because mind already has some sort of a tendency to go and grasp. Again, it grasps. Now you got to recognize that grasping. And again, you have to free the mind. So it becomes kind of a practice where you are observing the mind, you are being aware of the mind. Whenever it is going and grasping, you got to free it. You got to apply various vipassana techniques and to make it again free. So likewise, the practice has to be further grown. So here in this Anattalakkhana Sutta, so Buddha very beautifully mentioned, here all these volitional formations are non-self, are unsatisfactory, and again impermanent. On the other hand, they are impermanent. As a result, they are unsatisfactory. And it is not worthy of considering them as me, mine, or myself. So with that note, I'd like to conclude today's Dhamma sermon. Now I open the session for questions.
Avsarabhante, currently there's 6 questions. Question number 1, mindful sitting. Dear Swaminwansa, my sitting practice is observing the in-breath and out-breath after settling down and being mindful on the body. With your guidance, I managed to use the techniques I learned from this program to apply continuous mindfulness on the breath and see the transformation of it as well as the mindfulness itself. Once the breath starts to settle, subtle and fade away, my attention naturally goes to the posture and various subtle sensations and movements in the body again. During this time, I observe some element characteristics as highlighted in Swaminwansa's Dhamma sermons and question and answer sessions. My question is regarding the mindfulness on the elemental characteristics. During sitting, when I reach this state, I often feel the hardness and softness in various parts of the body. I cannot straight away say the location, but I presume mostly around the sitting posture. The hardness is observed against the softness in some other areas and seems not something absolute. They seem like entangled patches or feelings. In between them, I observe heat and cold patches as well. There seems to be some movement like slow flowing or pressure and release activity, but I don't have a name for that observation. My Dhamma knowledge is limited, and I only listen to Swaminwansa's and some Nisaravanya monastery recording. I feel like this is a problem to proceed, as I don't know the full picture of the elements to describe my observations or even to think about them. Much merits if Swaminwansa can explain to us how mindfulness of elemental characteristics can be done by someone who is at the stage of the practice. I hope it might help others as well. Thank you for your valuable guidance and to everyone who supports organizing this program. With metta, that's the end.
Yeah. So actually, recognizing various element characteristics, in a way we call it as Dhatu Manasikara, one of the prominent practices. And as you have mentioned, those various say element characteristics can say freely manifest. So you don't need to purposely arouse them. But rather, once your mind become calm, say you approach through anapanasati or rising and falling, whatever it is. But once your mind calms down, you can recognize all different types of bodily, this element characteristics. Now, when they arise, so you can select maybe a prominent element characteristic and you can focus your attention there and you start to observe that. So at the beginning, as you have experienced, there is nothing much. They appear like kind of a boring experience. Say when you are experiencing hardness, there is no any sort of a, say, big thing there. It appears like quite boring. But we are not sort of disheartened about that. Rather, we continue. So you are again and again observing this hardness. Assume that you another feeling is say another characteristic is popping up. Say it is a kind of a, say heat. So you are keeping your attention there. Now you are observing that. There also you probably might not experience any kind of a big thing. Rather, it's simply merely heat. So don't worry. Simply you have to continue. So as we are continuing like this, now you may understand. So many different element characteristics are always available in the body. Only when our mind is quite refined, once we have kind of a calmness in our mind, then only they start to be visible. It is not that we create them, but rather this whole body is a manifestation of all these element characteristics. But when our mind is quite refined, mindful, and say calm, quiet, concentrated, then only those manifestations are becoming evident. Now we are observing, start to observe various characteristics again and again. So we are continuing this practice. So as we are building up, so our capacity to look at them or to understand them precisely improves. So the clarity of mind improves, our resolution improves. As a result of that, at the beginning, they appear like kind of a single thing, but now they appear like small characteristics, very minute level kind of characteristics. And even though it may be kind of appear like hardness, it is not a kind of a say 1 inch area appear like hardness, but rather in that area there are little manifestations of hardness. Altogether, they appear like a single hardness. So these kind of findings are quite helpful. Now you have kind of a very focused attention, and with that focused attention, and again the say thin slicing of time, so you are able to recognize these say manifestations. Now assume that you are able to locate another place. It has say softness. It has say coolness. It has hardness, say it has kind of a flowing nature, it has kind of a vibration, so stiffness. So many different characteristics are there. Now you start to observe again and again, you do this observation. So as you are further and further improving, so you may understand continuously, this body is subjected to all these manifestations of various characteristics. It is nothing but element characteristics. Now the whole body becomes element characteristics. Now previously you didn't understand that manner. So here and there, seldom these characteristics are available. But now as your mindfulness refined, as your attention refined, well focused, so now you are able to recognize so much element characteristics. And what I'm telling is not many different times, maybe say 10, 12 types, but again and again throughout the body, again and again, what any of these are able to happen. Now this body is nothing but element characteristics. Now you lose the compactness. So typically we think this body is a single unit. So this is my body. This is beautiful. This is tall. This is fair. So likewise, we have all these different views. But now, when you are able to recognize these manifestations of the elements, so there you can't have any compactness. So everywhere are the manifestations, everywhere are different element characteristics, they come and go, rise and pass away. Now the whole solidity, whole compactness going to break. Now your body appear like kind of a burst, like in the kind of a transition between the channel. Say probably you might have noticed in the good old days we have that TVs, television. When you are changing the channels, so it can come to a particular channel which doesn't have any broadcast. So at that time only the dots are there, pixels are there, and they simply blasted onto the screen and nothing is there. So likewise, so you get a kind of a completely disintegrated kind of a body. It is not a compact body now. It's a kind of everything disintegrated. You can't have a solid body now. So you lose the solidity. You lose the compactness. Now again, you are further continuing. You are further and further continuing. Now to this disintegrated body, you can't have any kind of a lust. You can't have any kind of a desire. You can't have any kind of a liking. You can't have any kind of a self that is so impermanent, so unsatisfactory. So there is nothing substantial. It's like a continuous manifestations of different types of elements. And not only internally, and even if you pay attention to outside, you may understand inferentially, it's also there. The same situation. Whatever you see, whatever you feel, so everywhere, all the physical world appear like kind of a disintegrated whole. Now, this can lead to further and further dispassion. So like we discussed today, actually we have taken Sankhara Khanda, the volitional formations today. But as we discussed in the form aggregate, so when we are experiencing this kind of situation, so we lose the desire to the form. We lose the desire to this body. So we become kind of a dispassionate. As a result of that, the grasping disappears. So mind may start to let go this whole process. And mind might find its own kind of a freedom. So this kind of a process is there in the, what you call this Dhatu Manasikara, elements meditation. So it is a slow process. Don't expect what I have mentioned to happen overnight. It may take months of practice, may even sometimes years of practice. So therefore, it's a kind of a slow process, and it's the necessary amount of, say, focus of your attention, necessary amount of clarity of the attention, and again, the wisdom. So these have to be slowly developed. This is kind of a slow process. So it's a matter of continuing your practice, and I hope you found the answer.
Question number 2 of 7. General question. Dear Bhante, I recall in this program there are multiple highlights about day-to-day activities and how the sensitivity to these activities go up with the practice of mindfulness. I have been practicing for some time now and clearly observed that the amount of observations about my thoughts and feelings have gone up by several magnitudes. Earlier, for the practice, I was not aware of my thoughts at all. I had this notion that thoughts are me and I am the thought. The monkey jumps from branch to branch is me. After practicing mindfulness for some time, now I used to observe the thoughts as a third person whenever I become mindful. However, with this capability, I am seeing the good and the bad, or rather the ugly side of my thinking mind as well. For example, due to the recent pandemic situation, every day we hear job losses and difficulties people are facing. From the outlook and words, I sympathize with the others, but immediately I observe that I feel happy that this is not happening to me, and kind of a conceit that I'm above these peoples and the events. I cannot believe why I feel happy about someone else's miserable situation, and sometimes disgusted with myself. Even this hatred and aversion with myself, self-critical thoughts are clearly observable, and to stop this thinking cyclone, I tend to focus to my body and small sensations on the body. Sometimes this happens frequently, and I am afraid to look at my mind, and most of the time knowing the ugly side of it. I know this is not a healthy practice, and thought of writing to Bhante to get some advice. With all the respect and metta, that's the end of the question.
Interesting. By the way, I mean, you have honestly mentioned about your observations. So actually, so what is available is not that healthy kinds of thinking. So rather we may are sort of too much self-critical. So that is what happened here. And we always think that we should always think the positive way. We should have like kindness thought. We should have sympathetic thoughts. We should have compassionate thoughts. We should not have hateful thought. We should not have, say, egoistic thoughts. So likewise, we have these shoulds and shouldn'ts. But as we discussed today, so Buddha's teaching, the practice, is going a bit in between. It is not that we are trying to think the best thoughts. It is not that we are trying to think the wholesome thoughts every way, every time. Rather, we are trying to understand how impermanent even the wholesome thoughts, how impermanent even the unwholesome thoughts. So this is in a way quite deep. So the typical approach is that we want to free from, say, hateful thoughts and to have only the, say, generous thoughts, loving kindness thoughts. And that is also part of practice. Actually, that is called the one level of sammasankappa. So instead of having kama sankappa, vyapada sankappa, vihinsa sankappa, we want to have nekkamma sankappa, avyapada sankappa, vihinsa sankappa. So that is one level. That is one level of our practice that is also needed. So once you are able to have some idea, especially when you are going to, especially when you are reaching the Chittanupassana, so there you are giving equal value to these thoughts. So you are not trying to promote wholesome thoughts. You are not trying to be get rid of unwholesome thoughts, but rather you are observing them, how both sides are impermanent, how they are unsatisfactory, how they can't provide you lasting happiness, how transient they are. There is nothing substantial there. So as we discussed today, under the volitional formations, so that is the emphasis. So you can't have happiness merely by thinking always the wholesome thoughts. It may someday, it may collapse. And of course, you can't have happiness merely from the by having thinking the unwholesome side either. How about going in the middle, understanding the reality? So that is in a way the worth or the speciality of the Buddha's teaching. So there are Buddha mention. So all these mental formations, all these volitional formations, either they are wholesome or unwholesome, they are impermanent. They are unsatisfactory. They are non-self. So therefore, when one see this nature for himself, so he become dispassionate towards both sides. Not necessarily to have wholesome thoughts every time, not to get rid of unwholesome thoughts every time. Rather, he may understand both are impermanent. Both can't provide me lasting happiness. So instead, so he develops insight, he develops wisdom, and that wisdom makes the mind free from both. So this is the, in a way, the crux. So this is the most important point. There, Buddha is directing us to an area which is free from either wholesome nor unwholesome, but kind of a freedom. So this is the non-attached nature of the mind, unassociated nature of the mind, non-grasping nature of the mind. So there, Buddha mentioned, so this is worthy of, say, paying attention. This is worthy of taking as a refuge. Rather than you are trying to find refuge in the wholesome thoughts, how about finding refuge in this kind of a calmness, this kind of a peacefulness, emptiness? So this is the kind of a radical direction that Buddha is showing us. So therefore, don't become too self-critical about these kind of thoughts. So once you develop enough mindfulness, you are able to handle it. So more and more you start to observe your mind, so this shit is going to pop up. So don't worry. So it is common to everyone. Don't think that I don't have any of these say hateful thoughts or lustful thoughts. I do get these things. But rather becoming too critical about it, how about understanding their impermanent nature and find refuge in that peacefulness, in that emptiness in the mind? So that is the point, that is the direction that Buddha is leading us. So this is available to all human beings. And that is why even the Sopaka, even the Sunita, even when say Sariputta, so they are coming from different clans, different say social status, but still both, I mean, all of them have the same potential. So it is not that we are trying to think always the positive thoughts and become a good person. Rather, we understand the impermanent nature of all wholesome thoughts, understand the impermanent nature of all unwholesome thoughts. And when understand like that, so then you are becoming dispassionate about all these different kinds of thinking. So that is a very interesting part that Buddha is highlighting, so that we should clearly understand that, and that is where the direction that this Buddha is pointing us in the Vipassana practice. Yeah, we can move forward.
Question number 3 of 7, general question. Dear Venerable Bhante, what does Cheto Vimukti mean? I feel this means free from the mind. If so, what does Pranya Vimukti mean? Are there two steps a person has to step into, or two various variations people will take? Would you please explain this, Bhante? Much merits. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, I mean... There are different levels of Cheto Vimukti mentioned in the suttas. Say you can have freedom of mind even through samatha practices like Metta Cheto Vimukti. Say you develop loving kindness and you are able to spread loving kindness to every direction, to all the beings. Say so that you are not restricted, you are not limited to any group, any direction, but rather you can have kind of a universal kind of loving kindness spreading everywhere. So that is where you have a freedom of mind. So your mind is not limited now. It becomes unlimited, unmeasurable, immeasurable. So your mind has completely expanded. So that is the Cheto Vimukti. And you can gain that through Brahma Vihara practices from the Samatha. And on the other hand, in the, say, the Arupa Jhana, and again, one can have it through Vipassana practice, like Animitta Cheto Vimukti, Sunyata Cheto Vimukti, etc. So likewise, this is a very interesting area, some deep, say, topic. And on the other hand, Panya Vimukti is where when your mind get entangled and become delusioned, subject to any kind of a delusion. So there you are applying wisdom and trying to make the mind free. Say when we attach to something, there is a delusion inside. So we are probably, we may be expecting happiness. We may be imposing kind of a self to that. That is why mind go ahead and grasping. So once we are applying the non-self, so that is the wisdom. Once we understand there is nothing, no point of attaching, no point of holding, there is no person here, there is no self here. So there actually we are sort of triggering the wisdom. So once we trigger that wisdom, once we remind that wisdom, so there the mind become free. So because mind can't hold it further, because mind will understand, okay, no point, not worth of attaching. Not worth of telling it as me or mine. So the mind releases. Mind becomes dispassionate and then mind releases. So this we call the Panya Vimukti. So again and again, so we have to do this. So this is where the Vipassana practice is in a way maturing, where we are observing the mind, we are observing how it is grasping. And then and there we have to apply wisdom in order to release the mind. So this once released, again, mind is free. So again, back into the Cheto Vimukti. So likewise, this Cheto Vimutti and Panya Vimutti are quite, say, helping each other or dependent on each other. And I think that would be enough for this question. Yeah.
Question number 4 of 7, general question. Bhante, related to that, to the Dhamma talk, is it possible that mindful practice can also be driven by volitional formations, at least during the initial stages? Do we need to identify this, or will this get ironed out naturally during continuous practice? That's the end of the question.
Yeah, certainly, definitely. So actually, this doesn't mean that we should hate our thinking. This doesn't mean that we should completely stop our thinking. So probably you can listen to today's Sinhala Dhamma sermon. So actually we were discussing Samma Sankappa. So there are actually, I tried to highlight that. So it is not that we are trying to completely stop thinking. Rather, it's a kind of a, what Buddha pointing out, is kind of a mastery of thinking. Mastery of thinking. So whenever you find that it is beneficial to think, there you do the thinking. Suppose you want to plan something. That is your job. You want to design something. You want to kind of project something. So that, assume that is your job. So you got to do it. So thinking is a really strong skill we all have. So we can make use of it. But suppose that you finish it. Now you completed the task. Now you are simply coming back home. Suppose you are traveling by car or you are traveling by a public vehicle. So there, now you are not designing, now you no need of thinking. How about completely have a peaceful, calm, silence mind? So if you are able to have that silence mind, if you are able to have that stillness, calmness, so then you have some control over your thinking. So whenever you understand it is beneficial to think, so you make use of that thinking. And whenever you want to stop it, so you stop it. So that is the point that Buddha is highlighting. So this called vitakka vasita. Vasi vitakka pariyapatesu. So that is how Buddha in many ways explain it. So whenever you understand it is necessary to think, that you are skillfully thinking, and whenever you want to stop it, you have the capacity to completely stop it. Yeah.
Bhante, we have another 3 questions, but we're sort of nearly at the end of time. Do we have any extra time today?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay. Yes. All right. Question number 5 of 7, general question. Venerable Bhante, please guide us on how anicca may be used in our meditation practice. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, anicca in the sense, so again and again, when you are observing, say, as we discussed, say, element characteristics, so you will understand they are quite impermanent. They can't exist for a long time. Say, whenever your foot is touching the ground, so you feel hardness. So this hardness is impermanent. So whenever your foot is touching the ground, suppose you feel some softness. So that is also impermanent. It may change. So as you lift your, say, leg, so it disappears. So assume that you are doing sitting practice. So there are various, say, element characteristics manifesting. But they don't last for a long time. They change. And they quickly change. And assume that you are observing various feelings. So you understand how impermanent they are. I mean, say, various pleasurable feelings, they come and go. They quickly disappear. Various painful feelings, they quickly disappear. It is not, I'm talking about, say, pain that lasts for a long time. But when you are observing it very carefully, it is the very minute collection of feelings are there. So each individual, this minute feeling, it's a very short-lived. So how they are extremely transient, inconstant. So you understand this. So as you observe it, as you experientially, say, observe it, there you have your own understanding. It is not that since Buddha telling these as anicca, as impermanent, that they are impermanent. Rather, you yourself have to do the experiment. You have to use your focus attention in order to watch these various feelings, various element characteristics, various thoughts. So there you will understand for yourself that they are not permanent. So therefore, the practical approach is extremely important. So that is where you need to have the, say, focused attention, the concentrated mind, say, the inner chatter completely, say, disappeared. You have a very concentrated mind. With that concentrated mind, you are observing various element characteristics. You are observing various feelings. You are observing various thoughts. So there you will understand how impermanent they are. Yeah.
Question number 6 of 7, general question. Dear Bhante, this is kind of a philosophical question. When you understand that everything that you see, hear, feel, etc., at each moment is a projection of cause and effect, and that your job is to keep away from it and not get involved, would you share that knowledge with the audience? As an example, let's say if I am involved in a conversation with friends and family and there is a disagreement. If they are pushing for you to give an opinion on something that you don't want to give, and you want to keep away, but if they start provoking you to get involved, can I say to them, you don't exist? The situation here is due to a result of cause and effect. It will pass. My job is trying not to get involved. Do you think it is wise to do that? Please forgive me for asking a silly question, but I feel so like saying that sometimes. I feel like John Nash in the movie A Beautiful Mind, where he tells his mind-made intruders that they do not exist. Much merits for your answer. With metta, that's the end of the question.
I feel that we are trying to apply this non-self in a way, as I mentioned in the very early point. So we can't apply that in a typical conventional manner, telling that you don't exist, I don't exist. So they are, in a way, we are prematurely trying to apply that theory. So it is not the right place. So that is why in the Sammaditti, at the first, we have the Kammasakata Sammaditti. So we believe that there is a person. So I have to be a good person. I should not kill animal. I should not do any stealing. I should not do sexual misconduct. I should not lie. I should not take any intoxicants. So they are kind of a person. So this person has to be a good person, should not be a bad person. So there is a kind of a personality view. So this is accepted at that level. So whenever we are dealing with some mundane activities, so we are operating it at this level. So there you can't say as an excuse or as a way of say winning the debate, you can't simply say there is I don't exist or you don't exist. So that is in a way prematurely we are trying to put away kind of a logic. Rather, when you are developing further and further your understanding, especially through vipassana, so there is a level that you are reaching where this non-self is apparent to you. So it becomes evident to you. It is true observation. It is through an experiential knowledge. Say, there you can apply to yourself. It is not that you are trying to deny existing person. Rather, you understand how you make a person, how you create a person, how you create an I. So I making, mind making, that is how Buddha mentioned. Ahankar mamankar, I making, mind making. So you do some observation to your mind, and there you understand how then and there, how various thoughts comes in order to promote a self, kind of a self-affirmation, kind of a self-affirmative thoughts. So you recognize that. So these are the culprits in a way. So they are the ones making a self. So there you understand these thoughts. And these thoughts have to be disclaimed. So these thoughts you are clearly recognizing, and then you simply allow them to pass away, allow them to cease, rather than promoting them, rather than deluded by these thoughts and then make a self. Simply you are aware of the threat in them. You are aware of the trap in them. And you simply understand, so these are also thoughts. They are trying to delude me. And you simply allow them to pass. So there you can have the theory, non-self, theory of non-self. Therefore, in a typical conversation, mundane conversation, say while having dinner, say whenever you are trying to use a non-self approach, I think it is not a proper way of putting the Dhamma. Yeah.
Question number 7, this is the last one. General question. Bhante, if one is doing metta meditation, is there a time that there will be a revelation that loving kindness is also a volitional formation? That's the end of the question.
Yeah, certainly. Actually, at the beginning, as we said, discussing. So first, actually, we have to do it for ourselves and considering that is a person. And then say you are distributing, you are spreading metta to all the beings, say your say colleagues, your friends, etc. And then you are doing it for say, all the typical, say, equanimous kind of people. And then you even can go to the unliked people. And so likewise, you are breaking the boundaries. Now you are not limited to any group, any category of people, but rather you can spread metta to all the beings. So this is one level in a way. So this is where the samatha ends in a way. What we call the metta cheto vimutti. So that is where we can say the samatha approach is available, and that may be the kind of the culmination. But in the other hand, say when you do vipassana practice, so they are so if you really want to mix, say, loving kindness with, say, vipassana practice, it's better to have kind of a feeling of loving kindness. Maybe you can have quality of loving kindness. May you can have rather you better not to have kind of a personified loving kindness. Telling that I may be happy, you may be happy, you may be well, they may be well. So there are, if you do that kind of purposeful practice, it may, could be kind of detrimental to vipassana practice. Probably, I mean, if you can handle it without disturbing your vipassana practice, without harming your vipassana practice, it's fine. But more and more, it's a matter of keeping the mind and again, actually, you are recognizing various other types of cheto vimutti, as we discussed earlier. Another levels or another kinds of cheto vimutti going to be available. Like, say, animitta cheto vimutti, sunyata cheto vimutti. So those kind of cheto vimutti going to be available to the vipassana practitioner. So he can enjoy in that respect. So metta cheto vimutti can be dropped. And you can have this kind of a understanding or this kind of a practice. So therefore, using metta is not a bad thing. So it has its own benefits. You can use it. You can make use of it at your practice to some extent at your, say, at your early stage. Yes, in a way. So whenever you have some hateful thoughts, so you can replace that hateful thoughts with loving kindness thoughts. So that Buddha has approved in a way. Buddha has recommended that. But when you are developing mindfulness more and more, as you are developing further and further in your vipassana practice, so there you get another perspective into your practice. And then say metta is not a must. Rather you have some more powerful understanding And there you can use, make use of those understanding. Those, as I said, the vipassana approaches, you can make use of other than metta. Yeah.
That concludes the session for today. I'd like to first thank Bhante for giving up valuable time, especially for today. We've gone a bit over time, and also pass on our merits for continuing on with this valuable service for us, and also for the people seen and unseen who are participating and helping with the program, and also for the people on the Skype Zoom call. Because without you, there would be no program. So with that, I'd like to conclude the session. Therwan Saranai.
Yeah, Therwan Saranai.